Fairfax News 97.1 FM.
This is Countdown 2024.
Here are Charles Feldman and Margaret Carrero.
33 days to go before Election Day. We're in the home stretch. On today's show, we'll take a closer look at two of the biggest issues confronting Donald Trump and Kamala Harris. Voters deciding between the two, crime and foreign policy. Those are the two issues. But let's start with this.
Former Wyoming Congresswoman Liz Cheney campaigning with Vice President Harris today in Wisconsin. Cheney, who was the top Republican on the House committee that investigated the January 6th insurrection, has repeatedly characterized former President Trump as a threat to democracy and formally endorsed Harris just a few weeks ago. She is likely to lead efforts in the final month of the campaign to win over disaffected Republicans for Harris in several key battleground states.
After Donald Trump criticized the Biden administration's response this week to the devastation left by Hurricane Helene, Politico talked with a former Trump administration official who claimed that then-President Trump had sought to deny federal funds for fighting wildfires in California. That was back in 2018. It was only after Trump was shown voter registration data and told that, yes, there were lots of Republicans in places like Orange County who supported him, did he apparently agree to release disaster relief funding to the Democratic-controlled Golden State.
Kamala Harris continues her struggle with support from organized labor. The union representing some 300,000 firefighters across the country announced today that it will not be making any endorsement in the presidential race. The International Association of Firefighters was one of the first national labor unions to endorse Joe Biden against Trump 4 years ago. While Harris has endorsements from the vast majority of national labor unions, Democrats seemingly can't count on their support like they used to.
Now, depending on whether you're listening to Kamala Harris or Donald Trump, you might have radically different ideas about the state of crime trends in the country. If you are a Harris supporter, for example, you probably believe that crime rates across the board have been trending down over the last 2 years, this after peaking during the COVID pandemic. Now, if, on the other hand, you're a Trump fan, you probably believe that American cities are as crime-plagued and dangerous as they've ever been. So here to try to help us sort it all out, we hope, is Ronald Serpis. He's now a professor at the Loyola University, New Orleans. Before that, he served as chief of the New Orleans and Nashville police departments. Ronald, recognizing that there's the old adage that you can kind of do whatever you want with statistics, which candidate is closer to the truth? Is it Kamala Harris or is it Donald Trump?
Well, you know, more than two things can exist at one time. And in our nation, we have two crime reporting methods. One is the national FBI uniform crime, which has been showing crime is going down. The problem there is that it has about half the crimes don't even get reported because of the nature of the process. It's just been like this for decades. The other measure is the National Crime Victimization Survey since the early 1970s. That interviews more than 100,000 Americans every year and asks them if they themselves have been the victim of a crime. Each of these reports have detractors and supporters, and I'll say this to you, government data always lags the perceptions of people. Remember, the FBI only reports crimes that are reported to the police or known to the police and by those police departments that are voluntarily submitting that data under the FBI's rules. The National Crime Victimization Survey talks to 100,000 people or more a year, and we've known because of that data that about a half of all crime goes unreported. But here's the key difference, I would think. FBI shows murder, NCVS does not. And people think about safety around the crime of murder, one our most heinous crime. But in actuality, it's fairly rare. And when we know all what we can about a murder, 80% of the time, there was a relationship between the victim and the offender. But listen, this is the other key piece. Two final points. One, for every person who is killed by a gun, generally in your city, 3 to 5 other people are going to be shot in an attempt to kill them, and they survive, often with life-threatening, life-changing injuries forever. I was a police chief for 15 years and went to thousands of community meetings, and a Pew Research report that was done last week confirms my experience. Last point. People understand crime from what they hear from their friends, their families, their neighbors, and the local news, and people put more trust in what law enforcement tells them about crime than politicians tell them. So if you're using the FBI crime data, which is a data set that a lot of chiefs will use as well, it shows crime is going down. If you use the NCVS data in companion with it, it tells you that people are reporting significant increases in violent victimization in the last 3 or 4 years. A police chief won't use just one of those. A police chief is going to use both of those and then meet people where they live in their communities and find out from them directly how they feel.
So my question then for you is, with your background in law enforcement, how do you see the state of crime in this country?
I have always been one of the chiefs who was driven by data, but the data that I was the most concerned about was perceptions of communities. The reason being is that I know the FBI crime data is going to be about 50% off. And of course, we talk about it, but I will share this with you. I've been in a bunch of meetings in our earlier career when we were taught to say FBI data only, and we were seen as illegitimate by community members who said, well, I don't really care that you said robbery's going down. My cousin just got robbed yesterday. You see the point? So I would use FBI data naturally, and I would use crime victimization survey data in addition. And then I always polled communities where I worked. For example, here in New Orleans, there has been a dramatic decrease in crime after it went up dramatically. But the people in New Orleans, by a 56% margin in a poll just done 2 months ago, still feel like the city is unsafe. So these data points lag one another back and forth.
Let me ask you, is the fact that we have these two different data sets that don't really agree on a key figure, which was, of course, on the homicide rate, as you've pointed out, that allows, it would seem to me, a fair degree of political manipulation of these figures, because every politician can use whichever set of figures best serves their own political interests. Is that by design?
Well, I don't know if it's by design, but it's certainly by outcome, right? Mm-hmm. I think that is the outcome. And that's why the Pew report released just 2 weeks ago reinforces yet again, people trust law enforcement professionals to report the facts of crime more than they trust politicians, which maybe makes your point that people know the difference when someone's political swing is different from what they feel in their neighborhood in either direction. I don't feel safe. You should feel safe. I feel safe. You shouldn't feel safe. I trusted the people. Pew says 7 out of 10 people get that news from their friends, family, and neighbors. And I'm suggesting to you, that's exactly what I saw in thousands of community meetings over the years in 3 different states.
We are speaking right now with Ronald Serpis, a professor at the Loyola University New Orleans, previously served as chief of the New Orleans and Nashville Police Departments. Obviously, whoever gets in the White House, they're both going to do things very differently between Donald Trump and Kamala Harris. I wonder how you feel and what your thoughts are with Harris's background as a prosecutor. Do you see that as something that would be helpful in a president in helping to better tackle crime in the country?
Well, I think that what happens is when you get to the level of presidents, and I've been a chief officer since President Clinton was in office, and the varices that go back and forth between political parties is not as crucial as what happens in the day-to-day decisions to fund research, to fund community policing services, to fund the kind of practices that let us know how people really feel about crime. So quite honestly, I've been around Democrats and Republicans, and at the end of the day, you got to be able to support the fact that people might not agree with you, and let's try to find out what is the best possible information. So I don't really think it matters what their background was. I think what matters is how do we approach crime? And after doing this for 4 decades, you want an open mind. Whomever's got an open mind is probably better for the community.
Let me ask you this, too, because around the country, besides voting for president or senators or congresspeople, there are various jurisdictions, including right here where we are in L.A., that have votes coming up for L.A. County District Attorney. And in our D.A. race, we have a sitting district attorney who went into office as a so-called progressive. We have a challenger now who is claiming that crime is up because of these progressive policies, which leads me to the question, does the DA, any DA, have as much to do with a rising or falling crime rate as a police department does?
That's a really good question, because the police duty is to provide probable cause investigations to lead to an arrest. The prosecutor's duty is to create a beyond reasonable doubt conviction. The power rests in the prosecutor's office, not so much in the police. But they work in tandem, but they're really not on the same team because prosecutors have a duty to ensure they're enforcing equitable law, that you're not, you know, sandbagging people, you're not making false cases. But in my experience, prosecutors are probably the most powerful creature in a community like a city or a county, even more so than a mayor or a council, a whole lot more than a governor, and 10 times more than a president. Because our government is built at the local level, right? So Tip O'Neill, all politics is local. So we have 18,000 police departments in America, and we probably have 4,000 or so district attorneys. It's the district attorneys who make the decisions one way or the other, and they are elected directly by the people. And everywhere I'm familiar with. So it's going to come down to, do the people of Los Angeles County feel better or worse? And they'll make that judgment.
All right. Ronald Serpis is now a professor, as we mentioned, at the Loyola University New Orleans. And before that, he served as chief of the New Orleans and Nashville Police Departments.
We move from crime to foreign policy as we continue to look at the biggest issues that will help decide this presidential election next on Countdown 2024.
It's Countdown 2024
on KNX News 97.1 FM. This is Countdown 2024
on KNX News 97.1 FM.
Thanks for staying with us. Along with Charles Feldman, I'm Margaret Carrero. Perhaps not since the years after the September 11th terrorist attacks have foreign policy issues figured so prominently in a presidential election. International crises are seemingly everywhere today, from the Middle East to Ukraine to China and Taiwan. And with Donald Trump and Kamala Harris, American voters have to decide between two candidates with very stark differences in their approaches to foreign diplomacy.
Yeah, I mean, depending on who wins in November, U.S. foreign policy could be in store for some very massive shifts. So here to help walk us through some of these very complicated issues is Amelia Lester. She's deputy editor at Foreign Policy Magazine. Amelia, let's zero in for the moment on Donald Trump, since he's the challenger, and if he gets elected, there would be a marked shift in our foreign policy, since he's, by his own admission, an isolationist, and Kamala Harris would presumably continue the non-isolationist policies of the Biden administration. So if Trump were to win, how would his worldview impact these various flashpoints in the world, from the Middle East to North Korea to Ukraine and Russia?
Yeah, I think it's right to say that Harris represents the status quo. She very much identifies with a mainstream idea of American global leadership, whereas Trump defines America's interests much more narrowly. America First just about sums it up. He's also adopted what some have characterized as a transactional approach to the concept of alliances. He tends to ask what they can do for the United States right now. And that contrasts quite starkly with the national security establishment's approach, which is to treat alliances with a longer view and to adopt that kind of longer view about why they're beneficial. I think one big point of difference between the two camps is on the Russia-Ukraine war. The war is now in its third year, and Trump has made it pretty clear, most recently in his September debate with Harris, that he wants to end that war. He's pledged to settle it even before taking office. Now, he hasn't offered many details about how he's going to get there, but he has said he wants to get Vladimir Putin, the Russian president, and the Ukrainian president Zelensky in a room together and sort of hash it out in his very sort of personal transactional approach to these things.
I mean, yeah, he has claimed that he could get this ended in 24 hours. Is that realistic, though?
No, I think that neither Zelensky nor Putin see much common ground at this point. Zelensky's been pretty open with the American press about the fact that he doesn't think this is realistic. He recently told The New Yorker that Trump doesn't know how to stop the war. And he's actually called J.D. Vance, Trump's running mate, radical and dangerous, because Vance represents this rising faction in the GOP that is aggressively isolationist, that says they don't want any kind of U.S. intervention in foreign wars. And I think Vance, if he had his way, would actually stop the military aid that's flowing to Ukraine right now.
Is it accurate that the last time the U.S. was really an isolationist country, would that have been prior to World War II?
I think that's absolutely accurate. This is a big shift. And I think that you can see that also in this Russia-Ukraine debate. Now, what's less clear to me is what he would, whether he would follow through on that isolationism when it comes to the Middle East and with Israel's now two-front war there, because Trump has expressed support for Israel. That's also very much a mainstream view in the US. Polls show that Americans still consistently support Israel in that fight. And it's not clear to me that he would stop the flow of military aid to Israel that's been flowing. I think it's possible that both Trump and Harris would impose more conditions on that aid. Biden's been very reluctant to do that, in part because of his strong personal affiliation and connection to Israel. But I think both Trump and Harris would look to impose more conditions. Whether or not Trump would completely stop the flow of aid to Israel, I find that difficult to believe.
So would that make then, in your view, Trump sort of isolationist light?
Yeah, I'm not even sure if isolationism is the right rubric for Trump, because even in his first administration, he did send military abroad on very targeted missions. So I don't know if isolationist is as accurate as saying that he takes a transactional approach. If he thinks it will help the U.S., he's willing to put boots on the ground abroad, particularly on more targeted missions. I think for him, it's more about treating geopolitics as business deals rather than saying we're not going to engage with geopolitics at all.
Amelia Lester, stick with us. She is the deputy editor at Foreign Policy Magazine. We are going to be sticking with foreign policy to finish out today's Countdown 2024 right after this.
This is Countdown 2024
on KNX News 97.1 FM.
Welcome back to the Thursday edition of Countdown 2024, along with Margaret Carrero. I'm Charles Feldman.
Amelia Lester at Foreign Policy Magazine is with us to finish off our closer look at foreign policy in this presidential election.
Amelia, Donald Trump likes to point out to all the things that he says were not happening, bad things that he says were not happening in the world while he was in the White House, and he points his finger at the Biden administration and says, therefore, their more expansionist foreign policy has been a failure. How would you rate the Biden administration, and therefore, since Harris is vice president, really she's part of that, how would you have rated it?
Well, I think on the Middle East, which is obviously in the headlines right now, the reality is that the Biden administration's record has been one of real failure. It failed to broker a ceasefire deal between Israel and Hamas. Now Iran's fired missiles at Israel. The U.S. has helped Israel to shoot those missiles down. That's in spite of the fact that Biden made very clear to Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu that he did not want Israel getting involved with Hezbollah. And it was another instance of Netanyahu not following Biden's directives. On China, for instance, Biden has very much continued what Trump started. If there's one issue that Washington can agree on both sides of the aisle right now, it's that we are in a strategic competition with China. And Biden continued many of the Trump-era tariffs. In fact, he went further this summer. I think something that's been underreported or not appreciated by many is that Biden actually ordered heavy new tariffs on Chinese high-tech imports. And that makes the Biden administration the first since at least President John F. Kennedy to fail to negotiate a major free trade deal. Even Trump himself, who called himself Tariff Man, did push through a significant free trade deal involving the U.S., Mexico, and Canada. So I think on those two big issues, Trump is not far off the mark. One other thing that I think you can see as a continuation of what Trump started is he talked about Europe needing to pay its own way with NATO, with the NATO alliance. And it's true that the European countries did step up their contributions to NATO, and they're now at a high point. I imagine he'll continue that push to have them pay more and possibly even have the U.S. step back. There has been some reporting that he wants a radical reorientation of NATO, which basically involves a significant downsizing of America's role. So I can see where he's coming from in making that statement, for sure.
Amelia Lester at Foreign Policy Magazine, thank you so much for your time.
On tomorrow's show, we will hear from one Republican congressman who's fighting to save his job and one Democratic district attorney who's also fighting to save his job. Remember, we are here every afternoon at 2:30 through Election Day. And if you miss a show, catch up with a replay at 8 o'clock and on demand on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Just search for Countdown 2024 and follow the show.